This is Ask a Biologist, a program about the living world, and I'm Dr. Biology. While we often look at science and art as two different worlds, they're actually closely linked. For instance, you need to be creative in both science and art, at least if you want to be successful. And if you think about it, we design buildings and we design experiments. Both science and art include communication as part of their focus. And if you take some time, you're likely to find even more ways science and art really are kindred spirits. But one career that clearly shows how these two worlds are really one is the forensic artist. These are the people who can put a face on a skull of an unknown person. Often their work is the key to solving a crime or mystery that without their skills, talent, and knowledge might be left unsolved. My guest today is Katiana Falsetti, a forensic artist who's been helping to identify people for more than 14 years. She and her forensic anthropologist husband, Tony Falsetti, have been involved in a collection of cases and mysteries, and one we'll get to go back to, I hope, in this show, with our guest. Welcome to the show, Katiana Falsetti, and thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we delve into your world of the forensic artist, let's talk a little bit about forensic art.
There's many different types of forensic art. Forensic just means for use in court. So forensic art can be used to indicate any graphics that are used in court. So the most commonly seen types of forensic art are composite sketches. So a composite sketch is created when an artist sits down with the witness to help find an unknown suspect, and they'll create an image to be put out into the media to help identify that suspect. More accurately, that person would be a composite artist, as the majority of composite artists, that's their main focus, and they don't necessarily do the other types of forensic art. Other types of forensic art are age progression. So National Center for Missing Exploited Children does the majority of those, although I have training and other people around the country have had training for age progressions. Age progressions for children are done when there are abductions or children go missing to make them look older, or it can also be used for adults for long-term fugitives. Like in the case of John List, Frank Bender created an amazing facial reconstruction sculpture. There are also image clarifications or image enhancements. They're called two different type things. So we'll take video and then try to enhance that and sometimes create a drawing from those images. And then facial reconstructions or approximations, which is when we'll take skeletal remains of an individual and create a face from that. Or if there is enough flesh left on a person, we'll also do what I call a postmortem image. So if a person has some decomposition or some scars on them, I'll just use that photograph to create an image that can be put out into the media for unidentified individuals. And we have over 40,000 unidentified individuals in the country. Wow. Over 1,300 in Arizona.
I didn't know there were that many.
Yeah, it's called the silent epidemic.
Where did you start that got you on this path to be a forensic artist?
Well, I've always been an artist. I feel like I could probably draw before I could write. You know, my mother always was like, here's some paper, you know, go entertain yourself. And coming from a family of artists, that seemed to be the norm. So I was always interested in art. I was interested in history. I liked earth science and biology. Found it all very fascinating. Origin of humankind, and always loved museums, loved sculptures, loved looking at sculptures of busts of individuals, wax museums when they had wax museums, and like kind of as a normal thing. And I always wanted to do sculpting. I always wanted to do portraiture. I did my first portrait when I was 12, I think. And I studied fine art at Colorado State University for a year and a half. And then I took my first anthropology course and had always been fascinated by the origin of humankind, the idea of universal morality, cultures in general, how people have developed. So I switched to anthropology and history because it was kind of either you're a creative thinking person, art person, maybe history and English, but certainly not chemistry, biology, or physics on the other side. And I found that to be very detrimental looking back because, you know, my grandmother was a pharmacist, a tailor, an oil painter, a sommelier painter, as well as other creative things. And that was normal for her. I mean, she used her creative ability, her spatial thinking for multiple paths. And I mean, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, they weren't one or the other because it's all the same.
Right. And that's actually something that's very recent in history that we started to separate these out. It's not uncommon. You have the engineer, the architect, the artist. You know, it goes on and on. And what I found also interesting is the fact that you say you come from a family of artists. Your mother's an artist?
And scientist. I guess my father was an engineer. So, and my grandfather was, well, he's the Department of Treasury, so he was an accountant, businessman. And then the other side, it was teachers. They were English teachers.
There aren't that many forensic artists in the country. I mean, what I think I was doing some research, and there's, what, a little over 50 possibly out there. So while there may not be a lot of jobs, it seems like you would be in demand because there are lots of places that that kind of skill in both the science and the art are important. So whether it's a cold case that's more of a crime or, as we'll talk a little bit in a bit about the world of mysteries, some, you know, historical mysteries that are fun to deal with. So you obviously have found a love of this and have stayed with it. What is it about forensic artists? What is it that gets you up in the morning?
The possibility of helping give families or individuals the answers to what happened to their loved ones. So I have one case that individual was found in 1975 in Ohio, and he was unidentified and buried. And in 2012, he was exhumed, and then I was asked to do a facial reconstruction. In that case, I did a clay reconstruction. There was hair found at the location, so I could use that information. And I created a facial reconstruction. It went out on the media, and within, I guess, a day, the niece called in and said, "That looks like my uncle." And she and her brother both gave DNA samples, and he was positively identified. And
from 1975? Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I got to meet her and her brother, and they were very grateful to have those answers.
All right. So you mentioned that you were able to positively identify this gentleman with the samples from the niece and the nephew using DNA. So if we have DNA, why do we need forensic artists anymore?
Yeah, everyone thinks that there's a DNA database out there with everyone's DNA in it. And, you know, for privacy issues and lots of other reasons, that's not true. So the DNA of the individual, the unidentified individual, would never have been compared to his niece because she's not in the database. So what having forensic art does is, and through NAMUS.gov, I think NAMUS, so which is the first publicly searchable DNA database that is solely used for the identification of unidentified persons.
Right. So you narrow down that the field. So since you don't have DNA from everyone, you get the groups that say, oh, that looks like my uncle.
Right.
And then you ask at that point, can we have a DNA sample? And then you can get that match, which would never be possible otherwise.
You said that better than I did. And that's what all forensic art is. It's, you know, composite sketches. It's to narrow down the field of possibilities, you know. A composite sketch should never be used for an arrest. You know, facial reconstruction should never be used as a positive identification.
These are one tool.
It's just a tool on the step to a positive identification.
Let's talk a little bit about the tools of the trade. What are some of the tools that you use in your job?
Cameras. I mean, cameras are always very important. And when I first started doing this, I would either do a drawing. So I'd take photographs of the skull, a stand for the skull to put it on, to put it in the correct position, which is called the Frankfurt horizontal position, which is thought to be the most natural position of a person's head in the resting position. So a camera, scale.
So you can make sure you know measurements.
Right, because we need to have a scale because we're going to be using mathematical formula to do the approximation for the nose and the mouth and that kind of information. And historically, we would put the markers onto the skull. Now with Photoshop, I do it digitally, generally.
So are the markers only positioning on the skull spatially, or are they also giving you the depth?
They give you the depth.
The depth. Because one of the things, I'm learning just because I like doing research on my guests. And so one of the interesting things is you start with a skull. The question is how do you build it up into an actual living, breathing, in the sense, skin and muscles and all that. Part of that is through these measurements that have been done for a long time, right? People have been studying this?
Yeah, historically, I think the first tissue depth measurements were taken in 1893 by a German anatomist named Wilhelm Hiss. And he would take the measurements on cadavers. And that was the norm until about 2000 when they started using ultrasound. Mary Mannheim did a big study using ultrasound, which changes the dynamic completely because a corpse is lying down, number one, and then they're also dehydrated. And also the sample size was relatively small. And more recently, you know, we've been taking with ultrasound, with CT scans, and I've been working on a research project with Terry Simmons Earhart in Virginia Commonwealth University, and we've been looking at over 300 CT scans of live people and comparing the soft tissue to the facial bones and to see how that impacts the assumptions that have been made historically with facial reconstructions and creating new data for the future for more accuracy.
So, for example, where is the deepest amount of tissue on a face? Where would you find that?
It'd be in the cheek. I mean, the lower cheek right around the molar.
And so with the ultrasound, how accurate are those?
I mean, they're within like 0.2 millimeters. I mean, it's very high accuracy compared to the cadaver data, which the first time they would take the measurements, they would take a sooty needle, as the article described it. So they take a needle, put it over a flame to make it black, and then insert it at that point and pull it out and then measure the depth that the soot was gone.
Ah. It was good, but only as good as the technology of the day. So now we move fast forward, we have ultrasound, and then we have CT scans, which is what computer tomography, and that allows us to get some very precise measurements. And even better yet, it's on living humans so that we can have a bigger sample size.
Yes.
So when we were talking about tools of the trade, we have a camera.
Oh, right.
And we have Photoshop, right?
Well, historically, we have to have a stand for the skull. We use Duco cement still to glue the skull together. We use cotton balls to imitate any tendons or soft tissue spacers, as well as clay. I mean, we use oil-based clay, or some artists use water-based clay to do the clay reconstructions. And now, you know, we're moving into 3D software sculpting. And I've been using Blender a lot because it's an open source software that's out of the Netherlands and really great for educational purposes and sculpting purposes that anyone can use around the world. So there's an artist in Brazil that uses Blender exclusively for his facial reconstructions. Other artists use ZBrush more than anything else.
So this is sculpting in the virtual world.
Mm-hmm.
Does it allow you to try different versions? You know, what ifs? Because that's one of the things I find the computer allows you to do, explore much easier than if you're doing an actual clay model. It's a lot more tedious to do and then undo.
Yeah, just like in Photoshop, there's layers that you can make visible or turn off. So once you have the skill set of the software, it's easy.
What's your preferred tool?
Every artist is taught to draw. You know, I mean, that's the kind of the baseline. So drawing is enjoyable. Sculpting is satisfying, but it can take up to 2 weeks, if not longer. And you're also covering the skull, and you can't just use a layer to turn it on and off. And Photoshop is the fastest and the easiest so far, and I'm transitioning into the 3D software arena.
Do you use color in your work?
I always provide an image in black and white, and we will only do color if there's evidence to back that information up.
And what do you mean by that?
So if there's hair found at the scene, then I'll take the hair and I'll clean it off and I'll make measurements of the hair. Take pictures of the hair to try to get the most accurate color. And that's why Photoshop is great, is because you can use the eyedropper to get colors. And also if there's any clothing found at the scene, so if there's a shirt with a specific pattern or a dental implant with a specific pattern on it, we'll use that, or glasses that are found at the scene, or dental implants, meaning dentures, then we'll use that kind of information in color.
Is there a reason to avoid color?
People's perceptions are varied, and some of the population have expectations of images to be exactly accurate. And the more ambiguous we can be about the specifics, like a hairstyle or a hair color or a skin tone, the better, because then it makes the audience understand that there are possibilities of variance within that image, hopefully. And because I had a forensic artist when I first started, he said, yeah, I did this facial reconstruction in, I think it was in Norfolk, Virginia. And I used green clay because it's what they had. They had green clay. He did the reconstruction. And they took it over and showed the grandmother of the person that they thought it was. She's like, nope, not him. Okay. And they took the dental records. They compared the dental records. It looked like it was him. They took the image over to her again. And she said, that's not him. His skin wasn't that color. And I think that's the first time that you know, the artist started to realize is that everyone doesn't have the perception of an artist where, you know, like some people can walk into a house and say, oh, look, this would look great in blue and with gray drapes and this. And other people walk in and say, I have no idea what you're talking about. I can't even imagine that.
Right. They can't visualize.
Right.
It. Right.
And so we have to accommodate or try to accommodate people that can't visualize the color differences.
So what are the most common traits of a human head that we key in on is when we're looking? You know, what are the things that we typically see?
Humans generally recognize head shape first. So it's like if you see someone across the room and you think, oh, is that my friend? It's because that they kind of have the same body build and gait and head shape. And then
so long and narrow or rounded. Or,
right.
I get it.
And then different people notice different things, but, you know, some people have a very large nose or very big eyes or a big mouth, and that will stand out more. So I don't know among the features. It's more the positioning of the features. The features have to be positioned spatially in the right place for them to look more identifiable. And there are websites that if you, like, Google celebrities, you know, they will put, like, Tom Cruise's eyes close together or something, and they just look completely different. And that's the good thing about the skull is the skull will tell us where the eyes are, where the nose was, and where the mouth was in relationship to each other. And now the studies that we're doing is looking down into more of those details of lip width and positioning of the nose in relationship to the nasal aperture and the eyes within the orbits, so to try to get even a higher level of accuracy.
So if you have a long, narrow nose or a broad nose, those are things you're going to be able to know more with these databases?
That and like where your nostrils are in relationship to the nasal aperture, if it's right over it, if it's 5 millimeters below it, or the width of the nostrils.
One of the things that we were getting to talk about where you said, well, I can't put hair color on someone unless I have samples of their hair. The other question is, how do you know their skin color?
Now we're, you know, starting to work with DNA profiling, and they can help more with phenotype. I was just talking to one of the DNA specialists up at ASU West, and he's going to be helping us with a project. And I said, can you help determine what her skin color was? And he said, yeah, we should be able to.
Right. And so when we get into the genetics, there's genotype and phenotype. And with the phenotype, that's actually how we looked on the outside. So that would be our hair color, our eye color, you know, skin color.
Mm-hmm.
Is a skull accurate enough, or does it give you enough information to know if someone is very symmetrical? Because that's one of the interesting things. We have a tendency to look for symmetry. So really balanced on the eyes, balanced on, you know, as far as ears, where they're positioned. Do you get any clues from that, or is it not a good reference?
No, the bones are the starting point for the whole body, so they're very strong indicators of symmetry. Humans on average have 4 millimeters of symmetry or less, and if they have more than that, then it becomes noticeable. But everyone's asymmetrical, and that can definitely be seen on the skull. And I mean, every nasal aperture I've ever seen is asymmetrical. And so if you start looking at people's nostrils, it'll start to really freak you out.
You know, that'll be what we'll be doing from now on, is I'll be looking at everybody's nostrils.
Yes.
And saying, I'm looking across at you. Are your nostrils symmetrical?
But that's also an interesting point, is that one reason why people that have had plastic surgery look unnatural is because they're too symmetrical.
Uh-huh. Right. Too perfect.
Right. Which is unnatural.
In talking about these reconstructions, you touched a little bit about the clay reconstructions can take a couple of weeks. In general, when you use the different techniques, how long does it take to do a reconstruction?
Yeah, for a Photoshop reconstruction, I can do that within a day or two. And the 3D reconstruction will take around 2 weeks.
Okay. And then old school, you have to first do the clay model, then do the sketch. Can you ever do a sketch easily without having the clay model?
I would do the sketch first, and you don't need to do a clay model to do a sketch. You can just do a sketch.
Right off the skull itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the process of that is, again, just taking measurements, very precise measurements on the skull?
Yeah, taking photographs to scale, you know, having those photographs to either draw by hand over it on a piece of vellum or tracing paper.
Over the photograph?
Over the photograph that has the markers on it and the scale.
When talking about the world of computers, we have Photoshop and we have the 3D software that's coming from the Netherlands, and we're using now computer tomography, which is the CT scans and ultrasounds. I can't help but also think about the television show Bones. I know, I can tell you know where I'm going. So you have your fictional counterpart out there, who is the forensic artist on the program. And the
I have never seen it.
You've never seen it? Okay, well, you are Angela Montenegro, just so you know. And the intriguing thing about that is she comes from a background of artists as well. And it's interesting to me because she has a background also in computer science, because she has built this amazing computer that does these three-dimensional holograms. They call it the Angelatron. So, and with Hollywood, we always have to think, you know, okay, this is neat, but it's not necessarily real. But it does seem like you're moving in that direction. So is there going to be a Catianatron someday down the road?
I don't have a minor in computer science. I mean, there are softwares that are being developed, or that have been and that are being developed, to help create facial reconstructions with varying levels of accuracy and availability and helpfulness. So maybe, but I just feel like it's like computer animation for the movies. You're always going to need somebody with skill behind it to know how to use the tools. So the tool is going to be changing, but to have a creative human mind cannot be replaced.
No, and in this case, Angela, she uses it, and she's the only one that knows how to use it. Anybody else that tries to get on that machine or that instrument, it's always a challenge for them to use it. Let me shift into an area that we do with all my guests on Ask a Biologist. No one gets to get out of here without answering three questions. And yours will be a little bit unique because you're going to have the art and the science part. So the very first one is, when did you first know you wanted to be an artist or a scientist? And since you have, you know, you do both, where was the, what I call the aha moment? Was there an aha moment that you said, oh yeah, this is it?
I started studying forensic art in 1997. The reason I got interested in it was because I actually read a novel, because I always loved murder mystery novels. And I was in Brazil, and I think I had 2 weeks there, and I just kept reading through, I think I read 6 or 7 books that 2 weeks. I don't even remember the book, but I remember that there was an anthropologist who did a facial reconstruction to help identify an individual. And I thought, that's what I want to do.
And that was it. The course was set.
Yeah.
Okay. And how old were you again?
21.
21? Okay. Now, the next question is, I'm going to take all this away from you. And so I'm going to have to take away quite a bit. You're not going to be an artist.
I don't think I'd be alive then.
We'll hope we can figure out something there. And I'm going to take away the anthropology side and some of that. If you could be anything or do anything, what would you be or what would you do?
I mean, so that excludes writing too?
No, I think that includes writing. Do you want to be an author?
Yeah, I just finished and published my first novel. So it's a murder mystery novel called Facing Death. And it's digitally published now on Amazon and Nook and iBooks and some other platforms. And it'll be available for print in the next few weeks.
And what's the character?
The character is a forensic artist.
What's the first rule of writing? Write what you know.
Yep, and I did. It's the first book in a series, and I hope to highlight a lot of the issues with unidentified decedents as well as some other lesser known important issues that speak to me, like the Japanese internment camps in America or the massacres in Colombia or the mass deaths in South America or other places around the world. I want to highlight and educate people in an entertaining way, as well as educate about forensics in general. I mean, this first book I started 13 years ago, and it's kind of a coming of age of a young woman in the forensics field, which especially at that time was heavily law enforcement, so there are fewer women.
So what advice would you have for a young CSI person, you know, someone that wants to be a forensic artist? What would be your suggestions?
I mean, as far as majors go, I would say getting a degree in something like criminal justice or forensic science as a major and a minor in fine art. And especially, I mean, if you're an artist, you should always have strong drawing skills. But in addition to that, you know, computer animation skills or computer software skills.
Well, on that note, Katiana Falsetti, thank you for being on Ask a Biologist.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Ask a Biologist, and my guest has been forensic artist Katiana Falsetti. If you'd like to continue to explore the human skeleton and learn a bit more about bones, we have a fun section on our companion website called Busy Bones. Just point your browser to askabiologist.asu.edu/busybones, and you will find a collection of games, simulations, and experiments all focused on bones. If you'd like to catch up on the earlier interview with Tony Falsetti, you can just go to our podcast section and look for Skeleton Secrets. The Ask a Biologist podcast is produced on the campus of Arizona State University and is recorded in the Grassroots Studio, housed in the School of Life Sciences, which is an academic unit of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And remember, even though our program is not broadcast live, you can still send us your questions about biology using our companion website. The address is askabiologist.asu.edu. Or you can just Google the words, Ask a Biologist. I'm Dr. Biology.